Well, all right. Good afternoon, everybody. This is Scott Stevens here on the Jesus Factor on the Eagle Radio Network. Off to a more lively start, I hope, than we were last week. My apologies for that to all those that were listening. We've got a good show for you here today, one that deals with the factors that led to the revolution here and the splitting of Israel. After the intro, we have some important news of the day. Well, all right. This is Scott Stevens. And I'm glad that you stuck around to join me today. And I'm hopeful that we can get off to a better start than we did last week. Thanks to the help of my brother, Rick, out there in Arizona. I think we have the issues that I stumbled through last week taken care of. And we have taken some precautions to make sure that these things don't happen again. Interestingly enough, I've not run into a whole lot of problems with Sam. It's always worked well for me. And, you know, I guess like the way that we do in the Lord, we get a little complacent when things go just a little bit too well for us. And that can lead us to think that it will always be that way and not take the kind of care and the kind of diligence that we need to and the things that the Lord would have us do. This program being one of them for me. And before I go into the news, I mean, there was a lot said in today's services about our accountability and relationship with the Lord. And I know that for me, an important factor is to spend time diligently seeking Him, separating myself from the things that distract me in the world, and getting alone with Him. Coming to that place where I see in myself the great need for repentance and growth in Him. And seeking Him for grace in the midst of all that. Knowing that I am in a tragic state that cannot end well, but for His intervention. And for me, those are not formulaic things. And I mean, when I say that, I mean, I'm not here to try and offer listeners a formula. But I know that in my own experience, building that relationship with the Lord so that I'm confident in Him and at the same time recognize my own fallen state in the midst of that confidence and my need for grace in all that I do is a place where I can be confident that He will meet me. And I can experience the things of Him, the knowledge of Him, the power of His resurrection. All of these things being essential elements of our relationship with Him as believers. Without which, according to John 17, without that experience of knowing Him, there is no eternal life. So I know I encourage people in the midst of all of the reproof and the truth of our shortcomings, that we strive to seek after Him for that grace which He is so earnestly willing to provide when we will humble ourselves before Him and seek Him with everything that we have. Today, there's a bunch of stuff going on. I mean, the news was full of things this week that have to do with world events that point to things becoming ever more unstable. Peripherally, you have all the wildfires going on in the West, and you know, those are things that happen year to year and may just be seasonal in their occurrence. Lord knows, I don't. But I do look at the things that are going on in the Middle East as being very serious in nature. This week, the Defense Department announced an evaluation of Iran's military capacity. We've been speaking about Iran here for probably 7 weeks now on the News of the Day segment of the Jesus Factor. And I can tell you that now our Defense Department, as Israel has been saying for some time, is in agreement with Israel's appraisal of Iran's military buildup, both conventionally and their nuclear buildup, their race toward fissionable nuclear material that they can deliver on missiles, at the very least to Israel and parts of Europe presently. And based on the Defense Department's report, by 2015, they will have intercontinental ballistic missile capability if they are allowed to continue. On the heels of all this, we have a huge military armada, United States military armada, being built up in the Persian Gulf. Quietly and step by step, we are, thank God, putting our military at ready in the region. And clearly there were signals telegraphed to Israel this week that would suggest, even if not openly, that we will not stand in the way of or impede any action they deem necessary in the midst of Iran's military buildup. We know that in Syria we have a cacophony of wickedness going on with Assad seeking to retain power as many in the country revolt against him. We have him being supported by the Chinese, the Iranians, and the Russians. This is a frightening admixture in the Middle East. Economically, which, by the way, has much to do with our ability to wage any war and win it. Economically, we have what could be the fuse. I believe it began with the real estate collapse myself here in the United States. We have a further burning of said fuse brought on by the reckless commitments of governments in Europe to give their people things to keep them satisfied, naturally, in order to gain political power, and now not be able to make good on those things. We have cities around the United States, and if the forecasts are true, we have major cities such as Chicago and Detroit on the verge of filing bankruptcy, not honoring the commitments that they've made to those that have worked for them, police, fire, etc., over the years. What happens in a country where people expecting to get something, relying on it in a natural sense? These are people without faith anyway. And what happens when that thing that they rely on, that government that they've turned into a god, all of a sudden doesn't satisfy their every need and their every instinctual drive and their requirement to do even simple things like eat? Get reasonable help. What if the government runs out? It's already out. And this is just the deck chairs being rearranged on the Titanic. What's going on over in Europe is indicative of what will happen in any country where the government cannot meet its financial obligations. You have riots in the street. You have people going at each other. You have chaos. I hope and pray that it doesn't here and up in the United States. Well, all right. Now, back to... Now, we bring you back to the Jesus Factor here. A little music from the 60s, some Soul Deep from the Rascals, I believe it is. Today, we're going to talk about the factors that led to the revolution here in the United States. And normally, I spend some period of time talking about the Christianity of the day when I deal with a historical time. And later in the broadcast, I'll seek to give you all a link to some of the sermons that were being preached during this time by the various ministers of the day, and how freedom in every way was traced back to that freedom of choice, that free will that we are given and blessed with by the Lord. That was fundamental to the building of America, but there were triggers that led to the revolution, and many of them, in a natural sense, were not unlike, and we've spoken about this at some length here on the Jesus Factor of late, the similarities, or type and shadow, the figurative nature of Israel and Israel's relationship with Samaria, and how that split in Israel came to pass, and the relationship between Britain and the United States. And I thought it seemed good to me to go through some of this because it was pride and taxation. On the heels of a prophecy that was given in 1 Kings chapter 11, for those who want to go back and read how the Lord's judgment came upon Israel. But the playing out of all of this was a function of taxation after the reign of King Solomon, David's son. In 1 Kings 11:43, the last verse of that chapter, it says, "And Solomon slept with his fathers and was buried in the city of David, his father, and Rehoboam, his son, reigned in his stead." 1 Kings chapter 12 begins, "And Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel were come to Shechem to make him king. And it came to pass, when Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who was yet in Egypt, heard of it, for he was fled from the presence of King Solomon, and Jeroboam dwelt in Egypt, that they sent and called him. And Jeroboam and all the congregation of Israel came and spoke unto Rehoboam." Now Jeroboam was the guy who the prophecies in 1 Kings 11 dealt with. So you may want to go back and read some of this to fill this in. And one thing I can tell you, while there is no outward expression from people in Britain about the prophetic nature of their work in terms of service to the Lord, there is a clear, bell-ringing clear knowledge in the people that came from Britain, the pilgrims, the Puritans, those that left that place to come to establish this country, that parallel existed. And we've spoken at length about it, so we won't spend any more time on that today. But this is what the foundation of the split between Israel, what ended up being Judah, and Jerusalem, where the temple was, and ended up being Samaria, which we read so much about during the life of Jesus in the New Testament. And it goes on here in 1 Kings chapter 12, beginning at verse 4, it says, "Thy father made our yoke grievous, and now make thou the grievous service of thy father, and his heavy yoke which he put on us lighter, and we will serve thee. And he said unto them," this is Rehoboam, "depart yet for 3 days, then come again to me." And the people departed. In verse 6 it says, "And King Rehoboam consulted with the old men that stood before Solomon his father while he yet lived, and said, How do ye advise that I may answer this people? And they spake unto him, saying, If thou wilt be a servant unto this people this day, and wilt serve them, and answer them, and speak good words to them, then they will be thy servants forever. But he forsook the counsel of the old men which they had given him, and consulted with the young men that were grown up with him, and which stood before him. And he said unto them, What counsel give ye, that we may answer this people, who have spoken to me, saying, Make the yoke which thy father did put upon us lighter? And the young men that were grown up with him spake unto him, saying, Thus shalt thou speak unto this people that speak unto thee, saying, Thy father made our yoke heavy, but make thou it lighter unto us. Thus shalt thou say unto them, My little finger shall be thicker than my father's loins. And now, whereas my father did lay you with a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. My father has chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scorpions. So Jeroboam and all the people came to Rehoboam the third day, and the king appointed, saying, come to me again the third day. And the king answered the people roughly and forsook the old men's counsel that they gave him, and spake to them after the counsel of the young men, saying, my father made your yoke heavy, and I will add to your yoke. My father also chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scorpions. At the end of the day, this all dealt with the matter of taxation and was the functional way that the judgments that were prophesied in chapter 11 of 1 Kings came to pass in the nation of Israel in the time of Rehoboam, the son of Solomon. Here in the United States, there were a number of factors that led to the separation of these colonies from the Britons. And those factors began with the final colonial war between 1689 and 1763. This was the French and Indian War, it was called here in the colonies, which is the name given to the American theater of a massive conflict involving Austria, England, France, Great Britain, Prussia, and Sweden. They called it the Seven Years' War. The conflict was played out in Europe, India, and North America. In Europe, Sweden and Austria and France were allied to crush the rising power of Frederick the Great, the King of Prussia. The English and the French battled for colonial domination in North America, the Caribbean, and in India. The English did ultimately come to dominate the colonial outposts, but at a cost so staggering that the resulting debt nearly destroyed the English government. It was that debt that caused the escalation of tensions leading to the Revolutionary War. Parliament was desperate to obtain two objectives. First, to tax the colonies to recover monies expended on the battle over North America. And second, to restore the profitability of the East India Company in an effort to recover monies spent on the battle over India. The French and Indian War, as it was referred to here in the colonies, was the beginning of open hostilities between the colonies and Great Britain. England and France had been building toward a conflict in America since 1689. These efforts resulted in the remarkable growth of the colonies from a population of 250,000 in 1700 to 1.25 million in 1750. Britain required raw materials, including copper and hemp and tar and turpentine. They also required a great deal of money, and so they provided that all of these American products be shipped exclusively to England. This is called the Navigation Acts. In an effort to raise revenue and simultaneously interfere with the French in the Caribbean, a 6 pence tax on each gallon of molasses was imposed in 1733. This was called the Molasses Act, and as we will see, this is a series of acts of taxation that led to the burdening of the colonies in ways that those that were here viewed as unrighteous. Molasses was used in New England for making rum. In fact, it was in competition with other rum suppliers. A large trade had been growing between the New England and Middle colonies and the French, Dutch, and Spanish West Indian possessions. Sugar from the British West Indies was priced much higher than its competitors, and they also had no need for the large quantities of lumber, fish, and other items offered by the colonies in exchange. Sometimes colonists would pay Molasses Act taxes because they were rather low, depending on where they resided and how much money they had. In the first part of the 18th century, the British West Indies were Great Britain's most important trading partner, so Parliament was attentive to their requests. However, rather than acceding to the demands to prohibit the colonies from trading with the non-British islands, Parliament passed a prohibitively high tax on the colonies on molasses imported from these islands. If actually collected, the tax would have effectively closed that source to New England and destroyed much of the rum industry. Instead, smuggling, bribery or intimidation of customs officials effectively nullified the law. This is the beginning of actions in resistance to the taxing authority of Britain here in the colonies. During the French Indian War, prior to the establishment of this and other tax measures, the colonies were wholly interested in overcoming the French in North America and appealed to the king for permission to raise armies and monies to defend themselves. Despite sincere petitions from the royal governors, George II was suspicious of the intentions of the colonial governments and declined their offer. English officers in America were also widely contemptuous of colonials who volunteered for service. Now imagine this, we're in a British colony at this point, and our people volunteer for service, and they're rejected. A few militia, who as young men had dressed down and sent home, had been dressed down and sent home when they applied for duty. Such an experience was not uncommon, and it led communities throughout the colonies to question British authorities who would demand horses, feed, wagons, and quarters, but deny colonials the right to fight in defense of the empire, a right which they considered central to their service as Englishmen. So this is the beginning of that separation that's going on, and it was ministered by the rejection of Britain of service, not only by taxes, but a rejection of a desire to serve in the British military because of the suspicion and the pride of the British officers and the king. The king then imposed the Sugar Act. The Sugar Act was passed by Parliament on April 5, 1764, and it arrived in the colonies at a time of economic depression. It was an indirect tax, although the colonists were well informed of its presence. A good part of the reason was that a significant portion of the colonial economy during the Seven Years' War, that's the French Indian War for us here in America, was involved in supplying food and supplies to the British Army. Colonials, however, especially those affected directly as merchants and shippers, assumed that the highly visible new tax program was the major culprit. They blamed the tax for the economic depression. As protests against the Sugar Act developed, it was the economic impact rather than the constitutional issue of taxation without representation that was the main focus for the colonists. Enforcement of these regulations then became difficult. So the English government established extensive customs services and vice admiralty courts empowered to identify, try, and convict suspected smugglers. So now you have the use of British military order here in the colonies, used in order to repress the resistance to taxation. You see how this builds little by little, where in the end, of course, we know how it all turns out. It's easy to look back on things and say, well, this is what happened. But little by little, even though the colonists sought in many ways to tolerate and to negotiate what was going on with the Brits and the taxation imposed by the king and his occupation force that was here and had begun to separate themselves from the colonials, which were, after all, Britons at this point in history. These devices were exclusive of and superior to the colonial mechanisms of justice. And of course, this is what the problem was. Two of the prime movers behind the protests against the Sugar Act were Samuel Adams and James Otis, both of Massachusetts. In August of 1764, 50 Boston merchants agreed to stop purchasing British luxury imports, and in both Boston and New York, there were movements to increase colonial manufacturing. there were sporadic outbreaks of violence, most notably in Rhode Island. Overall, however, there was not an immediate high level of protest over the Sugar Act, either in New England or in the rest of the colonies. That would begin later, in the later part of the next year, when the Stamp Act was passed. The Stamp Act of 1765 was a direct tax. That means you're going to know it's there, you're going to see it, and if you have any sense at all, you'll recognize its impact on the economy around you. In the same way, if we have any sense at all today, we recognize the effect of taxation as a dampening effect on economic activity. The Act required, this is the Stamp Act, the Act required that many printed materials in the colonies be produced on stamped paper produced in London, carrying an embossed revenue stamp. These printed materials were legal documents, magazines, newspapers, and many other types of paper used throughout the colonies. Like previous taxes, the stamp tax had to be paid in valid British currency, not in colonial paper money. The purpose of the tax was to help pay for troops stationed in North America after the British victory in the Seven Years' War. So the rub of this continues. And I mean, keep in mind what we talked about here earlier in the broadcast. Maybe some have joined that weren't here, but the parallels between what was going on between the son of Solomon in his determination to tax more heavily all of Israel than even his father Solomon during the time of the building of the temple. Okay, the parallel of weighing more heavily on the people at a time of perceived peace. The parallel of what is perceived by the people, and Rehoboam's advisors, the older men, counseled him against this. I venture to say, and I know that we can find in history those that counseled the king against many of the actions that he was taking at this time. But the arrogance of the British aristocracy all the way up to the king made it unlikely that they would hear. The British government felt that the colonies were the primary beneficiaries of the military expense of the French and Indian War and should pay at least a portion of that expense. British Prime Minister George Grenville, and he was the Prime Minister there in Britain at the time, they had a parliamentary system of government in place, started appointing stamped distributors almost immediately after the Act passed Parliament. Applicants were not hard to come by because of the anticipated income that the positions promised, and he appointed local colonists to the posts. Benjamin Franklin even suggested the appointment of John Hughes as the agent for Pennsylvania, indicating that even Franklin was not aware of the turmoil and impact on American-British relations that the tax was going to generate, or that these distributors would become the focus of colonial resistance. At the time, of course, Franklin was not an elder gentleman and did not perceive how angry this would make the rank and file of American colonists. Because, you know, back then, the rank and file read the Word of God, they understood the righteousness of God, and the pulpits were full of ministers preaching of the righteousness of God and teaching about how that righteousness ought to be manifest in this new world. The view of those that were here was that this was a figure of New Jerusalem, a new world, a city on the hill, a place of hope for all those that believe the gospel. And in the pulpits, as this was all going on, the rightness of this cause was being established. And again, as the program moves on, I hope to paste a link for you to some of the sermons that were being given. There are books full of them about these issues. and the idea that somehow politics and religion, politics and faith, have become disjointed, disunited, and not taught as being essential, as counterparts, in order for any worldly political system to serve to the benefits of the spiritual good of the people. The only way in a cursed world that that can happen is that the power of God move through that system in order to bless the people. Much of the abundance that we have in our country today, whether we see it at this point spiritually as a blessing or not, in its origin came through the faith of those in this, the founding generation. Debate in the colonies over the Stamp Act had actually begun in the spring of 1764 when Parliament passed a resolution that contained the assertion that said, towards further defraying the said expenses, it may be proper to charge certain stamp duties in the said colonies and plantations. Both the Sugar Act and the proposed Stamp Act were designed principally to raise revenue from the colonists. The Sugar Act was to a large extent a continuation of past legislation related primarily to the regulation of trade, termed an external tax. But its stated purpose, to collect revenue directly from the colonists for a specific purpose, was entirely new. The novelty of the Stamp Act was that it was the first internal tax, a tax based entirely on activities within the colonies, levied directly on the colonists by Parliament. Remember, this is what Rehoboam said he was going to do in Israel. Because of its potential wide application to the colonial economy, the Stamp Act was judged by the colonists to be a more dangerous assault on their rights than the Sugar Act was. In May of 1764, Samuel Adams of Boston drafted the following that stated the common American position. For if our trade may be taxed, why not our lands? Why not the produce of our lands and everything we possess or make use of? Think about that. This, we apprehend, annihilates our charter right to govern and tax ourselves. It strikes our British privileges, which, as we have never fortified them, we hold in common with our fellow subjects, who are natives of Britain. If taxes are laid upon us in any shape without our having a legal representation where they are laid, are we not reduced from the character of free subjects to the miserable state?
In the morning, slaving for bread, sir, so that every mouth can be fed. Oh, me Israelite, sir. Get up in the morning, slaving for bread, sir, so that every mouth can. Choices ago. I don't want to end up like Bonnie and Clyde.
Oh, the Israelite.
After a storm, there must be a fall. Touch me in the palm, you sound your alarm.
Oh, the Israelite.
the Israelites. And, of course, this is what we are talking about here, some of the things that parallel in the matters of taxation that happened to split Israel into two separate nations that we know as Israel and Samaria during the time of the walk of Jesus, but as went forward from the time just after Solomon in Rehoboam and split with a guy by the name of Jeroboam, who you read about in 1 Kings, beginning in chapter 11, all right, and his prophesied reign. Massachusetts appointed a 5-member committee of correspondence. Probably learned this in elementary school if you got your history there. Massachusetts appointed a 5-member committee of correspondence in June of 1764 to coordinate action and exchange information regarding the Sugar Act. And in October of 1764, Rhode Island formed a similar committee. This attempt at unified action represented a significant step forward in colonial unity and cooperation. The Virginia House of Burgesses in December of 1764 sent a protest of the taxes to London, arguing that they did not have the specie required to pay the tax. Massachusetts, New York, New Jersey, Rhode Island, and Connecticut also sent protests to England in 1764. Although the content of the messages varied, they all emphasized that taxation of the colonies without colonial assent was a violation of their rights. In fact, they cited Magna Carta in all of this. Magna Carta, back in just after 1000 BC, AD, excuse me. By the end of 1765, all of the 13 colonies except Georgia and North Carolina had sent some sort of protest passed by colonial legislative assemblies. The Virginia House of Burgesses reconvened in early May of 1765 after news of the passage of the act was received. By the end of May, it appeared they would not consider the tax, and many legislators, including George Washington, went home. Only 30 out of 116 Burgesses remained. But one of those remaining was Patrick Henry, who was attending his first session. Henry led the opposition to the Stamp Act, and his resolutions proposed May 30th, 1765, were passed in the form of the Virginia Resolves. The Resolves stated, "Resolve, that the first adventurers and settlers of this His Majesty's colony and dominion of Virginia brought with them and transmitted to their posterity and all others His Majesty's subjects since inhabiting in this His Majesty's said colony all the liberties, privileges, franchises, and immunities that have at any time been held, enjoyed, and possessed by the people of Great Britain. Resolved that by the two royal charters granted by King James I, the colonists aforesaid are declared entitled to all liberties, privileges, and immunities of denizens and natural subjects, to all intents and purposes, as if they had been abiding and born within the realm of Britain, of England. Resolved that the taxation of the people by themselves or by persons chosen by themselves to represent them, who could only know what taxes the people are able to bear or the easiest method of raising them, and must themselves be affected by every tax laid on the people, is the only security against a burdensome taxation and the distinguishing characteristic of British freedom, without which the ancient Constitution cannot exist." Speaking of Magna Carta. "Resolved that His Majesty's liege people of this His most ancient and loyal colony have without interruption enjoyed the inestimable right of being governed by such laws, respecting their internal polity and taxation, as are derived from their own consent with the approbation of their sovereign or his substitute, and that the same hath never been fortified or yielded up, but hath been constantly recognized by the king and people of Great Britain." It's a little more flowery than the language that the people of Israel came to Rehoboam with. But after all, it's about the same thing. On June 6th of 1765, the Massachusetts lower house proposed a meeting for the first Tuesday of October in New York City. and it said this, that it is highly expedient that there should be a meeting as soon as may be of committees from the houses of representatives of burgesses in the several colonies on this continent to consult together on the present circumstances of the colonies and the difficulties to which they are and must be reduced by the operation of the late acts of Parliament for levying duties and taxes on the colonies, and to consider of a general and humble address to His Majesty and the Parliament to implore relief. Whether stimulated internally or externally, what ignited internally was ferment, civil unrest, that is, during the years from 1761 to 1766, which changed the dynamics of social and political relations in the colonies and set in motion currents of reformist settlement with the force of a mountain wind. Critical to this half-decade was the colonial response to England's Stamp Act, more the reaction of common colonists, people that were hearing from the pulpit, the messages that you can read via the link that I posted in the chat if you are interested. Some of these are long and involved, and the idea that we might not understand them, even though we've read the King James Bible, shouldn't surprise us, as our communication, our educational system, and our social condition has deteriorated under the weight of corruption because of the failure, our failure, to forcefully preach the gospel of Jesus Christ in these United States. Both loyal supporters of English authority and well-established colonial protest leaders underestimated the self-activating capacity of ordinary colonists. By the end of 1765, people in the streets had astounded, dismayed, and frightened their social superiors. Early street protests were most notable in Boston. On August 14th of 1765, Andrew Oliver, distributor of stamps for Massachusetts, was hanged in effigy from a giant elm tree at the crossing of Essex and Orange Streets in the city's South End. Also hung was a jackboot painted green on the bottom. A Greenville sole shoe. That's a pun on Grenville and the Earl of Bute, the two persons most blamed by the colonists. Of course, Grenville was the prime minister over there in Britain at the time. And now, had he been more humble in his dealings with the colonists, things might have been different. The sheriff, Stephen Greenleaf, was ordered by the lieutenant governor, Thomas Hutchison, to take the effigy down, but was opposed by a large crowd. All day, the crowd detoured merchants on Orange Street to have their goods symbolically stamped under the elm. The elm tree later became known as the Liberty Tree. At night, a crowd led by Ebenezer McIntosh, a veteran of the 17 Years' War, and a shoemaker, cut down the mock Oliver and took it in a funeral procession to the townhouse where the legislature met. From there, they went to Oliver's office, tore it down, symbolically stamped the timbers, and took the effigy of Oliver's home to Oliver's home at the foot of Fort Hill, where they beheaded and burned the effigy along with Oliver's stable house and coach chaise. Greenleaf and Hutchinson were stoned when they tried to stop the mob, which then looted and destroyed the contents of Oliver's house. Oliver asked to be relieved of his duties the next day. This resignation, however, was not enough. Oliver was ultimately forced by McIntosh to be paraded through the streets and publicly resign under the Liberty Tree. This, the most famous of political demonstrations of these times, was accompanied by demonstrations and violent resistance in many of the other colonies. The group known as the Sons of Liberty arose and was staunchly opposed to the British Stamp Acts and other abridgments of English liberty in the colonies. Groups identifying themselves as Sons of Liberty exist in almost every colony. The organization spread month by month after independence starts in several different colonies. August 1765 celebrated the founding of the group in Boston. By November 6th, a committee was set up in New York to correspond with other colonies. In December, an alliance was formed between groups in New York and Connecticut.
January bore witness to a correspondence link between Boston and New York City, and by March, Providence had initiated connections with New York, New Hampshire, and Newport, Rhode Island. March also marked the emergence of Sons of Liberty organizations in New Jersey, Maryland, and Norfolk, Virginia, and a local group established in North Carolina was attracting interest in South Carolina and Georgia. All people who recognized that their rights came from God, not from the government, and that the king, from the time of Magna Carta, hundreds of years earlier, had agreed that these rights would be inherited by British citizens. The colonies, of course, British possessions inhabited and led by British citizens. The leaders of the Sons of Liberty, heralded mostly from middle class artisans, traders, lawyers, and local politicians, Samuel Adams and his cousin John, were not members of the Sons of Liberty in order to not be directly connected with any violence that the organization may have precipitated. However, there were members of the Sons of Liberty that had influential power with people such as Benjamin Eads, a printer, and John Gill of the Boston Gazette. They produced a steady stream of news and opinion. Samuel Adams was connected to the Boston Gazette and published many articles under a pen name. This implies that Samuel Adams probably was participatory in the organization through writing, shared opinion, and association with prominent members. Though they were speaking out against the actions of the British government, they still claimed to be loyal to the crown. Their initial goal was to ensure their rights as Englishmen. Throughout the Stamp Act crisis, the Sons of Liberty professed continued loyalty to the king because they maintained a fundamental confidence in the expectation that Parliament would do the right thing and repeal the tax. Sounds a little bit like what's going on here in America today. Unfortunately, as we know, these expectations are often far too rosy in comparison with what actually is done. To add weight to their cause, the Sons of Liberty knew they needed to appeal to the masses that made up the lower classes. Several members of the Sons of Liberty, of course, were printers and publishers and distributed articles about the meetings and demonstrations the Sons of Liberty held, as well as about the fundamental political beliefs of the group and what they wanted to accomplish. They related in print the major events of the struggle against the new acts to promote their cause and vilify the local officers of the British government. After all, these were supposed to be brothers. Once again, we can look back to the ancient struggle that led to the separation of brethren in Israel. They related in print the major events of the struggle against these acts, and office holders identified by the Sons of Liberty as being part of the Stamp Act injustice quickly fell out of favor and lost their positions once local elections were held again. The Sons of Liberty would hold meetings to decide which candidates to support, those that would bring about the desired political change. In return, the British authorities attempted to denigrate the Sons of Liberty by referring to them as sons of violence or the sons of iniquity. Furthermore, the intercommunication afforded the colonies by the widespread nature of the Sons of Liberty allowed for decisive action against the Townshend Act in 1768. This essentially was the one that they finally had enough of. One by one, groups penned agreements limiting trade with Britain and imposing a highly effective boycott against importation and sale of British goods. While taxation is seen as the primary motivating force that led to the group's establishment, the work done in the Christian pulpits of the day provided the group with the authority to resist British dominion. Jonathan Mayhew wrote one of the most notable sermons predating the Revolution and delivered it on May 23rd of 1775. This is a portion of the book, the collection of sermons that were put together and available online free of charge. And it read, "It shall now be taken for granted that as we were freeborn, never made slaves by the right of conquest of war, if there be indeed any such right, nor sold as slaves in any open lawful market for money, so we have a natural right to our own, till we have freely consented to part with it, either in person or by those whom we have appointed to represent and to act for us. It shall be taken for granted that this natural right is declared, affirmed, and secured to us as we are British subjects by Magna Carta. All acts contrary to which are said to be ipso facto null and void." This coming from the pulpit, to say that a political act that is in contradiction to the fundamental doctrine of the nation from the pulpit in these days in a licensed church will get you closed down. And I forgot to mention at the beginning of the broadcast, there was a Bible study going on in Phoenix that was closed down because they failed to comply with certain of the local ordinances. And while they may not have been entirely correct in how they proceeded, the idea that any Bible study on any private property could be shut down by local authorities is not much different than this. And the idea that from the pulpit, a preacher would say with authority that those things that are in contradiction to those things which we are founded under some 700 odd years ago, in this case, Magna Carta, null and void, that took salt. And that, continuing in Mayhew's sermon, and that this natural constitutional right has been further confirmed to most of the plantations by particular subsequent royal charters, taken in their obvious sense, the legality and authority of which charters was never once denied by either House of Parliament, but implicitly at least acknowledged ever since they were respectively granted till very lately. Lip service to the constitutional authority and authority of Magna Carta. That's what Mayhew is saying here. It is taken for granted also that the right of trial by juries is a constitutional one with respect to all British subjects in general, particularly to the colonists, and that the plantations in which civil government has been established have all along, till of late, been in the uninterrupted enjoyment of both the rights aforesaid, which are of the utmost importance, being essential to liberty. It shall, therefore, be taken for granted that the colonies had great reason to petition and remonstrate against a late act of Parliament as being an infraction of these rights and tending directly to reduce us to a state of slavery. From the pulpit. It is moreover taken for granted, whatever becomes of this question about rights, that an act of that sort was very hard and justly grievous, not to say oppressive, as the colonies are poor and most of them were originally settled at the sole and great expense of the adventurers, the expense of their money, their toil, their blood, as they have expended a great deal from time to time in their wars with the French and savage neighbors, and in support of His Majesty's government here, as they have, moreover, been ever ready to grant such aids of men and money to the crown for the common cause as they were able to give, by which means a great load of debt still lies on several of them, and as Great Britain has drawn vast emolument from them in the way of commerce over and above all that she has ever expended for them, either in peace or war, so that she is beyond all comparison richer and more powerful and respectable now than she ever would have been if our fathers never emigrated. And both they and their posterity have, in effect, been laboring from first to last for the aggrandizement of the mother country. In this light, that share of common sense which the colonists have, be it more or less, leads them to consider things. It is taken for granted that as the surprising, unexampled growth of these colonies to the extension of His Majesty's dominion and prodigious advantage of Britain in many respects has been chiefly owing, under God, to the liberty here enjoyed herein, So the infraction thereof in two such capital points as those before referenced to would undoubtedly discourage the trade, industry, and population of these colonies by rendering property insecure and precarious, and would soon drain them of all their little circulating money. Would it be absolutely out of their power to purchase British commodities, force them into manufactures of their own, and terminate, if not yet in ruin, in the very essential detriment of the mother country? This sermon is a lengthy one, and it details many of the conditions that existed and why a preacher of the gospel felt moved to interpose himself in the midst of this, a seemingly political argument. It had to do, in their minds, with the liberty that God had given them. And they weren't willing to be deprived by the powers of this world of that liberty. We ought not to either. In every way, let us align ourselves with the good things of the Lord Jesus Christ. I thank you all for tuning in. Wish you all a blessed day. 1, 2.